who is trustworthy and will work for your best interests. You're in good hands with Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca to learn more about Kim's realty services and listings today. No one should have to choose between feeding their family and being able to afford basic hygiene products. One in five people who menstruate are likely to experience period poverty this year. United Way Kingston, Frontenac, Lennox, and Addington's Period Promise donation drive helps ensure no one in our community has to choose between basic needs and period products. From March 1st to March 31st, 2025, community members are encouraged to donate tampons, pads, liners, and other menstrual products. For drop-off locations and more information, visit unitedwaykflna.ca/periodpromise. You can make a difference locally.
This is Democracy Now!
One of our community members was taken by armed agents of the state who kidnapped her from outside of her home. People are here to stand up for the movement that she was punished for supporting, the movement for a free Palestine and to end the genocide in Gaza. And they're also here to continue to support our immigrant neighbors who have been getting picked up by ICE ever since, you know, not just Trump came into office, but Biden before him and every administration.
Over 1,000 protesters gather near Tufts University in Massachusetts to call for the release of Tufts graduate student and Fulbright scholar Rumeysa Öztürk after masked plainclothes immigration agents snatched her from the streets near her home Tuesday. Then voting rights under fresh attack. We'll go from President Trump's executive order requiring proof of citizenship to register to vote to next Tuesday's Supreme Court election in Wisconsin, where billionaire Elon Musk is backing a conservative candidate who could flip the court.
How corrupt is Brad Schimmel? Let's count the ways. One, Schimmel gave a plea deal to a man caught with child porn after the man's lawyer gave his campaign thousands of dollars. Two, Schimmel let 6,000 rape kits sit untested for years, then lied about it. Three, now Elon Musk is trying to buy Schimmel a seat on the Supreme Court because he knows Schimmel always helps his big campaign donors.
Then we look at the backgrounds of some of Trump's closest allies, the South African-born billionaires Peter Thiel and Elon Musk.
Musk lived what can only be described as a neo-colonial life. If you were white South African in that period and you had any money at all, you lived with servants at your beck and call.
We'll speak with longtime Johannesburg correspondent for The Guardian, Chris McGreal. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Plainclothes immigration agents have detained another international student without warning, Turkish national and Tufts University PhD student Rumeysa Öztürk. Surveillance video from a nearby house shows six masked agents approaching her on the streets of Somerville, Massachusetts, near her home Tuesday evening. She was with friends making her way to a meal to break her Ramadan fast. Tufts University's president said the school had no prior notice of her arrest, and the government officials said Öztürk's student visa had been revoked. Last March, she co-wrote a piece in the student newspaper criticizing the Tufts administration's response to Palestinian solidarity protests on campus, which were calling for divestment from Israel. In a statement, her lawyer says she successfully filed a petition to block her client's removal from Massachusetts, though ICE records indicate Öztürk was transferred to an immigration prison in Louisiana. Her lawyer, who as of yesterday evening had not spoken to her client, called the situation incredibly bizarre and concerning. Over 1,000 protesters poured into Powderhouse Square near the Tufts campus in Somerville Wednesday. This is Leah Kayali of the Palestinian Youth Movement.
We had had hundreds of Bostonians coming out here today because they are angered about what happens when one of our community members was taken by armed agents of the state who kidnapped her from outside of her home. People are here to stand up for the movement that she was punished for supporting, the movement for a free Palestine and to end the genocide in Gaza. And they're also here to continue to support our immigrant neighbors who have been getting picked up by ICE ever since, you know, not just Trump came into office, but Biden before him and every administration. So we are out here to continue to demand a free Palestine, to demand ICE out of our communities, and to fight for collective liberation.
This comes just weeks after the arrest of Columbia graduate student Mahmoud Khalil here in New York. Another international student was detained by ICE this week. Alireza Darudi, an Iranian doctoral student at the University of Alabama, though it's not clear why he was targeted. Meanwhile, in Washington state, authorities arrested farm worker union leader and well-known local immigrant rights activist Alfredo Lelo Juarez Zeferino. Protesters have gathered in front of Tacoma's Northwest Detention Center, where he's being held to demand his release. Israel's killed another 25 people in Gaza as it continues its relentless attacks. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is threatening to seize territory in Gaza if Hamas does not release the remaining hostages. Israel unilaterally shattered the Gaza ceasefire, ending discussions on the plan to release hostages. 17-year-old Palestinian teenager Waleed Khaled Abdullah Ahmed has died in an Israeli prison. The group Defense for Children International says he's the first Palestinian child to die while detained by Israel. His family said he suffered from scabies and dysentery while locked up in Israel's notorious Megiddo prison, known for its abuse of Palestinian prisoners. Waleed Khaled Abdullah Ahmed, who is from the occupied West Bank town of Silwad, had been jailed since last September. He's at least the 63rd prisoner to die in Israeli custody since October 2023. In South Sudan, opposition officials say the arrest of first Vice President Riek Machar marks the end of a fragile 2018 peace deal between Machar and South Sudanese President Salva Kiir, further tipping the country towards a new civil war. Machar is reportedly being held in his home after a convoy of heavily armed vehicles entered his Juba residence late Wednesday. An estimated 400,000 people were killed during fighting in South Sudan between 2013 and 2018. Tensions between the two rivals had been mounting, as have deadly clashes by armed groups, especially in South Sudan's Upper Nile state. In neighboring Sudan, Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan declared Khartoum is free after his forces seized Khartoum Airport from the rival paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. RSF fighters have been fleeing the capital in droves after the Sudanese army recaptured key sites in Khartoum over recent days. Brazil's Supreme Court ruled Wednesday former President Jair Bolsonaro will have to stand trial for his involvement in a 2022 coup attempt after losing the presidential election to Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. A federal police report issued last November accuses Bolsonaro of overseeing a plan to poison his rival, then-president-elect Lula, as well as to annul election results, dissolve courts, and install a military dictatorship. Bolsonaro will face five counts related to the sweeping coup plot, which could result in decades of prison time. Back in the United States, a federal appeals court has denied a request by the Trump administration to lift an order blocking the president from expelling immigrants out of the United States using the Alien Enemies Act of 1798. The court order came on the same day Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem visited the Supermax prison in El Salvador, housing over 200 men, mostly Venezuelans, who were sent there by the Trump administration in violation of a judge's order. Human rights groups have long decried the inhumane conditions inside the Salvadoran prison. Noem posted a video speaking in front of a group of prisoners.
First of all, do not come to our country illegally. You will be removed and you will be prosecuted. But know that this facility is one of the tools in our toolkit that we will use if you commit crimes against the American people.
The Trump administration claims all the Venezuelans sent to El Salvador were gang members, but has presented no evidence. The Miami Herald reports at least one of the men had just been granted refugee status weeks before. In other immigration news, CBS News reports the Trump administration's paused the processing of green card applications for immigrants who'd been granted refugee or asylum status. Meanwhile, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, has begun helping the Department of Homeland Security identify undocumented immigrants living in publicly subsidized housing. Canada and several European countries have updated their travel advisories for the U.S. in recent days in response to Trump's escalating crackdown on immigration and transgender rights. Members of Trump's circle have scaled down a planned trip to Greenland Friday, restricting their visit to a U.S. military base in the far north after major backlash from Greenland and Denmark. Vice President J.D. Vance announced on Tuesday he'd join his wife, Usha Vance, on the trip. It's unclear if National Security Advisor Mike Waltz and Energy Secretary Chris Wright are even going. On Wednesday, Trump reiterated his desire to take control over Greenland while speaking to the press.
We need Greenland for national security and international security. So we'll go as far as we have to go. We need Greenland, and the world needs us to have Greenland, including Denmark. Denmark has to have us have Greenland.
The U.S. Supreme Court voted 7-2 to uphold a Biden-era regulation that requires ghost guns have serial numbers, be sold by licensed vendors, and for buyers to undergo a background check. Ghost guns are assembled by users from DIY kits that are typically sold online and have previously been untrackable. In other Supreme Court news, the Trump administration's filed an emergency application seeking to cancel $65 million in congressionally appropriated teacher training grants it says will be used for diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. In news from Columbia University, the Oscar-nominated documentary filmmaker Julie Cohen has stepped down from the selection committee for the prestigious DuPont Columbia Journalism Awards. Julie Cohen, who co-directed the documentary RBG, said the decision came after Columbia, quote, so readily caved to the Trump administration, unquote. Three other jurors joined Cohen in resigning on Tuesday. Julie Cohen said in her resignation letter, quote, any thoughtful analysis of how institutions respond to creeping authoritarianism makes it clear capitulation is the wrong way to go, she said. To see our interviews with Julie Cohen over the years, go to democracynow.org. Meanwhile, in California, UC Davis has suspended its law student association and seized its funding in retaliation for the group's vote backing the BDS movement. That's the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against Israel amidst its war on Gaza. USAID is moving to end U.S. funding for Gavi, a global vaccine alliance that has procured life-saving vaccines for millions of children in poor countries for decades. Other cuts planned by USAID in a newly shared document include an anti-malaria initiative. Less than 900 active employees are currently staffing the agency, down from 6,000 before the Trump administration. Over 5,000 USAID projects have been eliminated. The gutting of USAID programs is being challenged in the courts. Gavi estimates the withdrawal of U.S. funding could lead to more than 1.2 million child deaths from preventable diseases. Calls for Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and National Security Advisor Mike Waltz to resign are increasing after The Atlantic magazine revealed both officials had discussed precise information about the U.S. bombing of Yemen on a group signal chat that accidentally included the Atlantic editor-in-chief, Jeffrey Goldberg. Hegseth posted detailed information on the timing and weapons used in the March 15th bombing before the bombing. Waltz revealed the U.S. killed one target by bombing the building where the target's girlfriend lived. The White House has downplayed the growing scandal, describing it as a hoax while claiming no classified information was shared, a claim widely disputed by former intelligence officials. Several Republican lawmakers are now calling for an investigation. During a House hearing Wednesday, Democratic Congressmember Raja Krishnamurti called for Hegseth to resign.
This text message is clearly classified information. Secretary Hegseth has disclosed military plans as well as classified information. He needs to resign immediately. He needs to resign immediately, and a full investigation needs to be undertaken with regard to whether other similar signal chats are occurring in this administration.
Elsewhere on Capitol Hill, far-right Republican Congressmember Marjorie Taylor Greene held a hearing Wednesday as part of a campaign to defund public media. She called NPR and PBS, whose heads were called in to testify, quote, radical left-wing echo chambers with a communist agenda, as she attacked, among other things, LGBTQ plus programming. Democrats on the panel highlighted Republicans' hypocrisy and called to fire Elon, not Elmo, in reference to the beloved children's program Sesame Street. This is Texas Democrat, the head of the Progressive Caucus, Greg Kassar.
My Republican colleagues don't want to talk about the corporate waste, fraud, and abuse because those corporations fund the Republicans' campaigns. So instead, they want to shut down educational programming for kids and their families, and they want to shut down local radio stations. To borrow a phrase from Sesame Street, the letter of the day is C, and it stands for corruption.
Trump announced a new 25% tariff on imported cars and auto parts. It's set to take effect April 2nd, which Trump's been referring to as Liberation Day. The tariffs will also apply to U.S. brands that have been assembled outside the country. Consumers could see car prices shoot up by $4,000 to $12,000. In a major upset for Pennsylvania Republicans, Democrat James Malone won a state Senate seat in a district that voted for Donald Trump over Kamala Harris by more than 15 points in November. Democrats also won a Pennsylvania House race Tuesday, and possible early signs of widespread voter opposition to the Trump administration. This comes ahead of two key special elections for the U.S. House in Florida next Tuesday, including a race to fill the congressional seat left empty by Matt Gaetz. Trump's endorsed the Republican candidates Randy Fine and Jimmy Patronis. But despite the races taking place in deep red districts, Democrats Josh Wahl and Gay Valamont have out-fundraised their opponents. There are currently 218 Republicans and 213 Democrats in the U.S. House. And the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts has fired at least five members of its social impact team, including its artistic director, the renowned artist Mark Bamuthi Joseph. The team aimed to expand the Arts Center's reach to diverse audiences and to commission new works by Black composers. The job terminations come weeks after President Trump took over the Kennedy Center, named himself chair, and fired most of the board of trustees. Mark Bamuthi Joseph recorded this video from his office after learning of his firing.
Well, I am sitting in my office at the Kennedy Center one last time. It's funny, I'm taking things down, like this red, black, and green American flag and this extraordinary piece of artwork that my man Greg made that honors Stevie Wonder, and this poster from BAM, and a commemorative album that was organized by Swiss Beats. Basically, I'm taking down everything Black in my office, just as the new leadership of the Kennedy Center is doing its best to disavow much of the literal color that has made this place special.
Mark Bamuthi Joseph speaking after being fired as artistic director of social impact at the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts after President Trump took over as chair of the board. This past weekend, Mark Bamuthi Joseph performed his piece, Carnival of the Animals, an allegory to January 6th and the insurrection. He performed it at Alice Tully Hall at Lincoln Center here in New York. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today in Massachusetts, where over 1,000 protesters gathered near Tufts University Wednesday after mass plainclothes immigration agents snatched Rumeysa Ozturk, a Tufts PhD student, from the streets of Somerville. Ozturk is a doctoral student in the school's Department of Child Study and Human Development. She's a research assistant at Tufts Children's Television Project. She's a former Fulbright scholar who was born in Turkey. Surveillance video from a nearby house shows agents approaching her on the streets near her home Tuesday evening. In the video, you can hear her scream as the agents move to detain her.
I'm
Rumeysa Ozturk was making her way with friends to a meal to break her Ramadan fast. Tufts University's president said the school had no prior notice of her arrest. Last March, Ozturk wrote a piece in the student newspaper criticizing Tufts' response to Palestinian solidarity protests on campus, which were calling for divestment from Israel. Democracy Now!'s Hani Massoud and Ariel Boone were in Somerville at Wednesday night's protest.
And immigrants are under attack. What do we do?
I am executive director of Muslim Justice League. I want to start with an attorney statement to clarify. I am not Rumeysa's attorney, but this is a statement shared from her attorney, Masa Khambabai, just to start us off. Thank you all for coming out to support Rumeysa this evening. I hope to speak with her soon and will be telling her about the outpouring of love and support. Unfortunately, I recently received word that she was transferred to Louisiana. I don't understand why it took the government nearly 24 hours from her detention to let me know her whereabouts. DHS would have been made aware of the Habe filing last night. Why she was transferred to Louisiana despite the court's order is unfathomable. Rumeysa should immediately be brought back to Massachusetts, released, and allowed to return to complete her PhD program. Our country is built upon a system of laws and accountability. We look forward to her having her day in court.
Stand up, fight back!
Stand up, fight back!
Stand up, fight back!
Stand up, fight back!
Hello, everyone. My name is Nicole, and I am an East Somerville resident, and I am one of the volunteer coordinators of the Somerville Ice Watch Network. The city of Somerville and many other cities in Massachusetts call ourselves a sanctuary city. But what does that really mean if our neighbors are being disappeared by state violence for weeks and there's been silence and inaction? What our community needs to know is that how horrifying this incident and Rumeysa's kidnapping may be, this is the terror and the threats that our immigrant neighbors live under every single day.
My name is Sam Alterman. I am a PhD grad worker at Tufts University, and I am proud to be one of the head stewards for the Tufts University Graduate Workers Union, SEIU 509. I'm even more proud to call Rumeysa Ozturk a colleague, a union sibling, and a friend. Our union stands shoulder to shoulder with Rumeysa, with Mahmoud Khalil and Mamadou Ta'al, and with every worker in the United States who is attacked for exercising their free speech rights. We believe that all workers, regardless of citizenship, visa status, or documentation, have a right to be safe in their workplace and in their communities, to speak their minds without fear of retaliation or harassment, and to participate in civic life. 100 years ago, during the first and second Red Scares, the federal government also attempted to shamelessly and violently abuse immigration law to chill free speech and attack working people. The labor movement fought back then, and we need to fight back now.
Yeah, Leah Kayali, and I'm with the Palestinian Youth Movement. We had hundreds of Bostonians coming out here today because they are angered about what happened when one of our community members was taken by armed agents of the state who kidnapped her from outside of her home. People are here to stand up for the movement that she was punished for supporting, the movement for a free Palestine and to end the genocide in Gaza. And they're also here to continue to support our immigrant neighbors who have been getting picked up by ICE ever since, you know, not just Trump came into office, but Biden before him and every administration. So we are out here to continue to demand a free Palestine, to demand ICE out of our communities, and to fight for collective liberation.
I'm Fatima Ahmed. I'm with Muslim Justice League. Can you describe what happened to Rumeysa? Yeah, so as far as we understand, you know, Ramesa was actually under surveillance maybe for a day or two by ICE agents. So her neighbors actually reported seeing these cars, you know, parked on the street for about 2 days. And then she was on her way to an iftar with her friends. And you can see very clearly in the video that, you know, these people just surround her and take her. They don't, you know, explain who they are. There's no indication on their, you know, no vests, nothing, no badges or anything. And so neighbors who saw this were, of course, frightened and reported it, assuming that it was ICE, and it was ICE, in fact, that took her. I think 9/11 and the war on terror was obviously a huge escalation in not just surveillance and policing, but the structure of the government, right? Creating the Department of Homeland Security, creating ICE, which are now, you know, these massive departments eating up our budgets and coming for our community members. And every step of the way, you know, many community members have spoken out and said, we can't accept these things. We can't keep adding more and more surveillance, more and more policing, more and more militarization. It will eventually come for all of us. And I think this is the moment where a lot of people realize it is coming for everybody.
Some of the voices from over 1,000 protesters who gathered near Tufts University Wednesday evening after mass plainclothes immigration agents snatched Ramesa Ozturk, a Tufts doctoral student, from the streets of Somerville, Massachusetts. When we come back, we speak with Mother Jones voting rights correspondent Ari Berman and go from President Trump's new executive order to require proof of citizenship to register to vote to next week's Supreme Court in Wisconsin election, where the billionaire Elon Musk is backing a conservative candidate who could flip the court. He's promising to pay voters. Stay with us. Instead of being afraid. The Empire by Wise Blood. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Not content with spending more than $250 million to elect Donald Trump, we look now at how the richest man in the world, senior advisor to President Trump, Elon Musk, is pouring money into an election in Wisconsin. Musk has spent more than $18 million to support the Republican Brad Schimmel over Democrat Susan Crawford and has been paying Wisconsin voters $100 each to help flip the Wisconsin Supreme Court. This would allow Republicans to keep gerrymandered districts in place and control Congress. If Democrats retake the House, they could investigate Musk, Doge, and his millions of in government contracts. For more, we're joined by Ari Berman, voting rights correspondent for Mother Jones Magazine, author of Minority Rule, The Right-Wing Attack on the Will of the People and the Fight to Resist It. His recent pieces are headlined, Elon Musk Revealed Why He's Spending Millions to Flip the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and The Wisconsin Supreme Court Election is a Referendum on Elon Musk. So much is happening with voting rights. Let's start in Wisconsin, then we'll move on from there. Ari, can you lay out what's at stake? Why Wisconsin is about the country, and then, of course, will affect the world.
Well, good morning, Amy. The Wisconsin Supreme Court is important in its own right because this election on April 1st will determine which party and side controls the ideological majority of the court. And that will decide things like the fate of Wisconsin's 1849 abortion ban, laws restricting labor rights, the legality of Wisconsin's congressional maps, which could decide control of Congress. But it's taken on much more significance because Elon Musk is now spending over $20 million to try to flip the Wisconsin Supreme Court, which is a record for any state judicial race in the history of the United States. And it really has become a test of whether Musk can buy Wisconsin like he bought the White House and can extend his plan for oligarchy to the states, or whether Democrats can fight back and strike a tangible blow against him, and whether there can be a reaction to all of the things that he's done in Washington that he's now trying to do to the states. And so it's an extremely important race in the state, in one of the most important swing states in the country, but it really has taken on a tremendous amount of national significance since Musk got so involved in this Wisconsin Supreme Court race.
And explain, what is paying $100 to voters mean? What's that about?
So Musk is paying voters $100 a pop to sign a petition opposing quote-unquote activist judges. And I just saw that he has now given $1 million to a supposedly random winner of the petition signing, which is just a staggering amount of money. And he's going to keep doing that every 2 days until the election. And this is just a crazy scheme in a state Supreme Court race. Remember, Amy, this is about electing judges. These are people that are supposed to be impartial in terms of how they rule. And basically what Musk is doing is he's taking the playbook that he used, which was very controversial, very legally suspect, certainly ethically dubious in terms of getting Donald Trump back in the White House. And he's trying to use it in a state Supreme Court election in Wisconsin. And we've never seen this kind of thing in a judicial race before. We've never seen this kind of money in Wisconsin before, or any other state Supreme Court race. We've never seen these kind of tactics in a state Supreme Court race before. And so just the level of corruption at play here, the level of money at play here, really is a warning sign for what's happening to our democracy.
So you're a voting rights specialist journalist, and this comes amidst a slew of other election news. On Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments against Louisiana's voting map that includes two majority black districts that could also help shape the balance of power in the House. And President Trump signed an executive order Tuesday to overhaul U.S. elections and stop the counting of votes after Election Day, including absentee ballots sent by mail. And on Wednesday, Utah's Republican Governor Spencer Cox signed law to end the state's popular universal vote-by-mail election system. If you could talk about all of that.
Yeah, so I think the most significant of those three so far is President Trump's sweeping and really unprecedented executive order, which would give the president the authority that he really doesn't have under the Constitution. The Constitution gives the states and Congress the power to set the rules for federal elections. Trump is trying to take that power for himself in a really crazy voter suppression scheme that would make it harder to vote in so many different ways. It would require proof of citizenship to register to vote, which could disenfranchise tens of millions of Americans who don't have ready access to those documents, like a U.S. passport or potentially birth certificates or naturalization papers. It would hamper vote by mail by saying that if ballots are postmarked by Election Day, they won't count if they arrive after Election Day, which is currently the law in 18 states. It would put Elon Musk in charge of searching voter rolls and searching for suspected voter fraud, which could just lead to incredible abuse and further access of sensitive voter information. So really, the president is trying to do an illegal power grab that would provide voter suppression on steroids and take away so much power that is currently reserved for the states and for Congress and make it so much harder for people to vote at a time that we're entering a really crucial election cycle. That's on top of the fact that before the Louisiana Supreme Court, white voters are basically trying to dismantle a second majority black district in that state to try to turn the Voting Rights Act on its head, to take away representation for black voters. Republicans at the state level are continuing to make it harder to vote through things like chipping away at mail voting, like in places like Utah, where it's very popular and widely used. So there's a lot of disturbing things on the democracy front. And I think this all really fits together, which is that there's just this five-alarm fire for democracy happening all over the country. And it's taking many, many forms. But one of the most tangible forms it's taking is the attempt to try to restrict participation in elections and to try to put in place a form of oligarchy instead of a form of democracy. You see that in Wisconsin with Elon Musk trying to buy the Supreme Court race. You see it in Washington with Trump issuing executive orders that are clearly unconstitutional. You see it at the state level with how Republicans are ripping away voting rights. So I see a through line to all of these different anti-democratic tactics.
And of course, there's Trump's new executive order that would require proof of citizenship to register to vote. Ari Berman, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Voting rights correspondent for Mother Jones Magazine. Next up, we look at the backgrounds of some of Trump's closest and most powerful allies, the South African-born billionaires Peter Thiel and Elon Musk. Back in 30 seconds. Exhuming McCarthy by R.E.M. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show with part two of my recent interview with the reporter Chris McGreal, who is the Johannesburg correspondent for The Guardian during the last years of apartheid through 2002. He's been closely following the South African-born billionaire Elon Musk, who was born in 1971 in Johannesburg, South Africa, and raised under the country's racist apartheid laws. Some of McGreal's pieces include, what does Elon Musk believe, and how the roots of the PayPal mafia extend to apartheid South Africa. I began by asking Chris McGreal to discuss Musk's grandfather, Joshua Haldeman.
We see Musk's grandfather, Joshua Haldeman. He immigrates to South Africa in 1950. And that's really when apartheid's just starting to kick in. The 1950s are when the first laws... South Africa had discriminatory laws before, but you see the specific apartheid laws, which are much more aggressive and in many ways reminiscent of the Nazi Nuremberg laws against Jews in the 1930s. They have very similar echoes in stripping black people from the right to work in certain places, their movements, controlling them, confining them to areas. You already had a situation which is now, you know, come to the fore because of recent events with Trump. But
you mean with Elon Musk giving the Nazi salute?
Yes, but also with the sanctions over land, is that the 1913 Land Act had already deprived most black people of land in South Africa anyway. At that point, the 7% or 10% as it was of the population that was white owned more than 85% of the land under the Land Act of 1913. So the apartheid laws kick in the 1950s. Elon Musk was born in 1971 in Johannesburg, and at that point the Prime Minister was a guy called John Forster. And John Forster's background is very telling, really, because Forster in the 1930s had been a member of a neo-Nazi militia called the OB, which was openly sympathetic and linked to the Nazis in Germany. It was responsible for all kinds of attacks, but including burning Jews out of their businesses in Johannesburg.
And we're talking about what years?
In the 1930s, so the late 1930s. And then South Africa goes to war as an ally of Britain against Hitler. The OB and the groups that support them, like Forster, they actively oppose that. They actually are in touch with, OB is in touch with German military intelligence, and they plan to assassinate the Prime Minister of South Africa, Jan Smuts, and overthrow the government and have it support Hitler. That plan fails because the Germans are unable to provide the necessary weapons and back out. But in 1942, John Forster, later Prime Minister, stands up and gives a speech, and he talks about the system that their kind of ideological belief system, which was Christian nationalism. And he says, Christian nationalism in South Africa is the same as Nazism in Germany and fascism in Italy. It's all anti-democratic. It's all the same thing. By 1971, when Elon Musk is born, that man is the Prime Minister of South Africa. And Christian nationalism is the basis of not only the political philosophy, but the entire education system that Elon Musk is brought up into.
So take us from Elon Musk's grandfather moving to South Africa in the 50s to his father, how they gained their wealth.
So Elon Musk's grandfather moves there in the 1950s. He's not particularly prosperous. He arrives without a lot of money, but it's Elon Musk's father, Errol, who makes the real money, principally through investments in emerald mines in Zambia. And, you know, mining conditions in southern Africa in that period were really pretty dire in the 1960s and 70s. Very high death rate, very poor conditions, but the owners got very rich. And Musk lived what can only be described as a neo-colonial life. If you were white South African in that period and you had any money at all, you lived with servants at your beck and call. You lived in sprawling housing. What you see with Errol Musk is that when we get a glimpse into just how much money he had when he and Elon's mother get divorced, she says at the time that, well, he owns a yacht, he owns a jet, he owns several houses, so there was considerable wealth there.
Was the grandfather of Elon Musk on the record in his support for Foster?
Well, he was certainly on the record in his support for apartheid, very vividly so, yes. And he said that that's why he'd moved to South Africa from Canada in 1940, was in support of it. Now, the grandfather himself is killed a few years later in a plane crash, but it's not known what Elon Musk's grandmother's personal views of Foster particularly were, but they were both avid supporters of the apartheid system, and the grandmother lived for a number of years afterwards.
So you've been talking about Elon Musk's maternal grandparents and how they moved to South Africa, but talk about their roots in Canada.
Originally, the grandparents have no connection to South Africa. They're born and grow up in Canada. And in the 1930s, the grandfather, Joshua Haldeman, he's head of the Canadian branch of a U.S. movement called Technocracy Incorporated. And Technocracy Incorporated is essentially a movement to overthrow democratic government in the United States and have technocrats, but big businessmen in many ways, come in and run the country. That's partly a reaction to FDR's election and New Deal and massive reforms that he's introduced in the United States.
So from Canada, they would help to launch a coup against FDR?
No, Canada had its own branch of this movement to overthrow the government in Canada. Haldeman heads that branch. And through the 1930s, it takes on increasingly fascist overtones. They start wearing grey uniforms, modelled on the Nazi brown and black shirts. And so when Canada declares war on Germany in 1939 alongside Britain, the movement is banned because it's clearly sympathetic to Hitler. Then Haldeman is arrested. Elon Musk's grandfather is arrested. They find documents sympathetic to the Nazis and other subversive documents inside his house. And he is sent to prison for a few months and then remains on essentially a subversion watch list for the rest of the war. Yeah, so he's basically regarded as a Nazi sympathizer, a fellow traveler.
And about a decade later, he moves to South Africa. Why?
So after the war, he founds another political movement which has deep anti-Semitic roots and actually promotes the forgery, the protocols of the
Elders of Zion.
Elders of Zion, that's it. But obviously after the war and the Holocaust, there's no real appetite for that in Canada. It's a failing political movement. And so his eye casts down to South Africa. By 1950, the apartheid government has been in power for 2 years. And Haldeman looks at it and thinks, that's just my kind of place, which clearly that was what he would want to create in Canada and had been trying to create in the 1930s. And so that's the point at which he and his wife, May, they move to South Africa and become very fervent supporters of apartheid.
Now, I wanted to blend in some breaking news. In addition to cutting off all aid to South Africa, news of the region, and that is Sam Nujoma, the freedom fighter turned president who led Namibia to independence from apartheid South Africa in 1990, has died at the age of 95, often referred to as Namibia's founding father, known for his motto, a united people striving to achieve a common good for all members of society will always emerge victorious. Used to be called Southwest Africa, became the independent Namibia. Talk about Sam Nujoma and how that fits into this picture of South Africa through apartheid.
So Sam Nujoma was the head of the Southwest Africa People's Organization, which was the liberation movement of Namibia.
SWAPO.
SWAPO, indeed. Really, SWAPO takes off and is able to have effect after Angola becomes independent with the fall of the Portuguese dictatorship. The Portuguese colonizers leave Angola, and Angola provides a base then for SWAPO to really fight to liberate Southwest Africa. That becomes known as the Border War. Euphemistically, the South Africans call it the Border War. They actually invade Angola in an attempt to overthrow the Marxist-leaning government of Angola, but also to keep SWAPO at bay. But the war goes on, and eventually South Africa loses that war. At that period, though, one of the things you see is that Peter Thiel, another member of the PayPal mafia, very close friend of Musk, he had been at school in Johannesburg, but his father gets a job on a uranium mine near Swakopmund in what is then Southwest Africa. And so Peter Thiel moves there as a child and goes to school there. And the thing to know about Southwest Africa, or the reason it was separate from South Africa, is that it had been a German colony until the end of the First World War. Then it becomes falls under South Africa's mandate, partly because at that point South Africa was a British colony. When South Africa becomes a republic in the 60s, it hangs on to Southwest Africa and it becomes a South African colony. But the population, big part of the population, was of German ancestry. And you could. I remember going to Windhoek in the early 90s, and the main thoroughfare through Windhoek was called Hermann Göringstrasse, named not after the Luftwaffe chief, but after his father, who had been a governor of German Southwest Africa. In Swakopmund, it was even more extreme. It was notorious for many, many years, really into the 80s and 90s, as a hotbed of open support, continued support for the Nazis and for Hitler. The New York Times has a story from the mid-70s of a reporter pulling up at a gas station to get his car filled with gas, and the attendant openly giving a Nazi salute and saying Heil Hitler to him. You could go to curio shops in Swakopmund and they would sell Nazi-themed mugs and flags and things, and they openly celebrated Hitler's birthday every May. Thiel went to a German school there, so that's the atmosphere he grows up in. His father is an official on a uranium mine there. And the interesting thing about the uranium mine, amongst many other things, is that it supplied part of the uranium to develop the South African atomic bombs in the 1970s, which were developed in league with Israel. Now, part of the deal with Israel was that is that South Africa would deliver yellowcake uranium to Israel. We don't know where the yellowcake came from. It may have come from that Swakopmund area mine, or it may have come from somewhere else in South Africa. But South Africa was shipping yellowcake to Israel at the same time, because it too was developing nuclear weapons.
And talk about what Peter Thiel has said about all this. You know, I remember as we cover conventions for decades now, Peter Thiel standing up at the first Republican convention that nominated President Trump and, you know, supporting him and who he is.
So Peter Thiel has said of his time in Swakopmund, and particularly the school, which he describes as particularly a brutal education that it turned him against government and into a libertarian. And I think that's an interesting element in all of this, is that one of the things that isn't necessarily appreciated outside of South Africa is that there's two kinds of whites there. There's the Afrikaners who we've been talking about, but there's a big English-speaking white population. And one of the aspects of the English-speaking population was they, on paper, said they opposed apartheid, but they gained all of its benefits. And they, most of them, certainly not all, there were some really heroic individuals, but most of them did very little to actually end apartheid. But one of the products of that is you have people like Musk and Thiel, who have done very well and whose parents did very well out of the apartheid system, who deny responsibility for it. They blame it on the Afrikaners, they blame it on a government, extreme government, extreme right-wing government. But then they have to explain how it is that their own parents were so able to do so well out of apartheid. And then they put that down to individual talent, that they're naturally gifted, and that leads them down this whole libertarian path, anti-government path, because essentially they have to explain how they too were benefits of apartheid without taking responsibility.
And talk about their relationship, Peter Thiel and Elon Musk.
Well, they're co-founders of PayPal together. They both essentially share the same kind of worldview from what I can make out. They're, you know, libertarians. They're very opposed to any kind of DEI. You've seen their deep hostility to DEI. I think Thiel buys into the same message about anti-white, the war on white people in South Africa that South African white groups like AfriForum have been pushing in the United States. So I think that, you know, philosophically, they're very similar, and obviously they have a very close relationship.
And then talk about David Sacks, and talk more specifically about what you're referring to as the PayPal mafia. I don't think most people in this country understand all of these connections and this unusual situation where these some of the wealthiest men in the world worked together, founded PayPal, and now surround the president of the United States.
Yes, so David Sacks was born in Cape Town in the 70s, and He moves, his parents take him to Tennessee when he's 5 years old. So he didn't grow up in the same milieu as Musk and Thiel. But he did grow up in the white South African diaspora, for sure. He clearly shares the same views. You know, as you say, they're part of the PayPal mafia. They all get rich from the creation of this company. They're all at the top running it. And now Sachs has emerged as Trump's AI and crypto czar, again, part of the same project. So you can see this.
And he was a chief fundraiser for President Trump, as you said, born in Cape Town.
Yes, a big. So they've all emerged with essentially, from what I can make out, the same philosophy. And, of course, that's only been reinforced by their success. They're convinced, obviously, of their own genius and worth, and that government, whether it's South African government or in this case it seems to be the US government, is an obstacle to success.
And then we talked about it in part one, finally Roelof Botha making this little quartet, white men of a certain age together, and his history also a part of the PayPal mafia.
Yes, he's part of it, and he has not emerged as an open supporter of Trump. I'm not entirely sure what his personal views are on this, but he does have a very interesting background. His grandfather was Pik Botha, who was the last foreign minister of apartheid South Africa. And Pik Botha's job essentially was to go around the world, particularly the West, and assure them that apartheid was being amended, was being dismantled, when in fact it was in many ways, although what was known as petty apartheid, which was the routine discriminations, the segregation, was being dismantled. In fact, the political system was actually only reinforcing it, solidifying it. The government of the time cooked up a system of three parliaments that would represent different parts of the population, but and give people who weren't, some people who weren't white, a vote. But none of those people were black. There was no black parliament, partly because they were being pushed into the independent homelands. The idea was that they were no longer South African anyway. So Pik Botha went around trying to apologise and excuse for this system. And he was successful with, you know, conservatives. He saw a lot of Reagan and people. They loved him here. And the same with Thatcher in Britain. They saw him as the acceptable face of apartheid. And he was so deluded by the end. He was convinced. I remember meeting him during the era of the transition to democracy from apartheid. He was so convinced that he was indispensable to the system that Mandela would have to appoint him foreign minister, which he duly did not.
Would you say the background of all these men's families was fleeing Mandela's South Africa?
Well, some of them left before. I mean, it's worth noting that Elon Musk left in 1988 at the age of 18, just as he would have become eligible to be drafted into the South African army, as all white males were at that point, which might have led him to fight the border war that I was talking about in Angola against SWAPO, or it might have led him into the townships, which at that point were in complete ferment. And, you know, you had a huge amount of civil unrest in South Africa at that point. The country had largely become ungovernable. It was under a state of emergency, and the white troops were trying to keep some form of order in the black townships like Soweto. He left before he had to do any of that.
Mm. So very interestingly, for people aren't aware, Elon Musk had a company called X.com. It was an online bank. It merged with Confinity in 2000 to form PayPal. The merge company was renamed PayPal in 2001. And you have all of these guys who you've just laid out. Well, I think Botha is a partner at Sequoia Capital, but now key players. And that brings us to Trump's order on Friday to cut off all aid to South Africa and offer refugee status in the United States to the white South Africans who are, quote, victims of unjust racial discrimination. But interestingly, many in the right-wing white lobby say they want to stay and focus on ending black majority rule. This is Flip Bass, the chairperson of what's called the Solidarity Union.
We might disagree with the ANC, but we love the country. As in any community, there are individuals who wish to immigrate. But the repatriation of Afrikaners as refugees is not a solution for us. We want to build a future in South Africa.
So he is speaking in front of a sign that says Afroforum. Put this in context. And what about Afrikaners saying, no, this is our land. We don't want to come to the United States.
Well, Afroforum is backpedaling furiously now because there's been a huge backlash in South Africa from people who blame it for this situation. In fact, some people have accused it of treason. But if you look at what Afroforum was saying just a decade ago, and certainly in 2018, when people like Kali Creel, who was head of the AfriForum, and others were coming to the United States, they were claiming there was a white genocide. They were claiming there was a war on white people in South Africa. And they were essentially trying to characterize the post-apartheid era of one of oppression of Afrikaners, that they were the true victims of it. And this is they're not alone in this. There had been a phenomenon ever since the end of apartheid of Afrikaners painting themselves as victims. There was a song emerged in the 1990s called De La Rey. It was very popular with Afrikaners. It was sung in bars and rugby matches. And De La Rey was a famous general who fought to the bitter end against the British in the Boer War, the Second Boer War, in the early 20th century, which the Afrikaners then lost. And this song essentially is an attempt to take Afrikaners back to a time when they were the victims, when it was their women and children dying in the British concentration camp, when they were the people who were oppressed. And it conjures up this Boer general who, he may be losing the war, but he's going to fight to the last, a bitter ender. And this is how they've been characterizing themselves, some of them. And Afroforum is part of that kind of attempt to rewrite history and make out that they're this minority that has long been persecuted, not just by the post-apartheid era, but by the British, and they have a long history. And apartheid was just a means of survival. All they were trying to do was to keep themselves and their culture alive. It has had one other effect, which they hadn't expected and has alarmed them, is that in all the orders that have been given out cancelling aid and agreements, one of them affects agricultural products being imported to the United States, which have generally been duty-free as a means of helping Africa. One result is that their own products are no longer being imported duty-free into the United States. So these white South African farmers who've been complaining of oppression will now actually be being hit with tariffs or regular duties. And so it's going to cost them financially, which is one of the reasons they're so upset by it and pretending that it was nothing to do with them.
Guardian reporter Chris McGreal. He was the Johannesburg correspondent for The Guardian during the last years of apartheid through 2002. We did this interview in early February. Over the past 2 months, Trump has suspended aid to South Africa, expelled the South African ambassador, and offered refugee status to white South Africans, claiming South Africa's discriminating against the white minority. Trump has also just nominated Leo Brent Bozell to be U.S. ambassador in South Africa. Bozell's son was sentenced to nearly 4 years in prison for his role in the January 6th insurrection before he was pardoned by President Trump. One note on Elon Musk's family. May Musk is Elon's mother, not his grandmother. To see part one of our interview with Chris McGreal, you can go to democracynow.org. We'll also link to his pieces. What does Elon Musk believe? And how the roots of the PayPal mafia extend to apartheid South Africa. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Wolf Island and Kingston Massive, Saturday, April 5th.